dog, however, who got his bite late in the chase, is still yelping, if not performing new tricks. So we're going to start with Christian Anderson, who was added to this panel just within the last week, thanks to some phone conversations between his father and myself, and then with Christian personally, who is here from, who lives in Palo Alto, is that correct? And what's your current academic situation there? Christian, should have got this from you before I started.
I just graduated from Stanford.
Has just graduated from Stanford in?
Biology.
So we'll start with Christian, and then on his left is Angela Toscano, who has most recently been the poetry editor of Ellipsis, the literary magazine at Westminster College, where she has just graduated. And on her left is Melissa Sillito, who recently made a professional move from a career in Salt Lake Public Library System. She is now working at the 4th Street Clinic, a clinic for homeless folks. And what do you do there, Melissa?
I'm the development director, so I go out again.
I knew that already, but somehow I forgot it. Melissa is the development director, and she's the kind who could make it happen. So we will ask Christian to read first, and we'll go down the line, and I'll be last.
Whatever you wish.
All right. Well, thank you, Paul, and thank you to Sandstone for being able to read some of my poems with you. Most of my poetry, at least all of the poems I brought with me today, were written while I was still in high school, so that was very young. I think that the poetry bug, though still in my bloodstream, has not been active recently, and it was definitely my first experience with real poetry, my first understanding of poetry, was an English class I had in 10th grade with Emily Dickinson. That was the first time I actually thought of poetry as something meaningful, as opposed to a lot of words that could have probably been said more concisely in the technical manual. The thing I love so much about Dickinson's poetry, though, that I've always struggled to get back to, is how passionately she describes the essence of everyday things and everyday experience. That there's a real sense that she is looking at her life through a very different lens than the rest of us. And the only thing at that point I felt I really felt was that passionate about was running. And so a lot of my other poems are running in various forms. And I think I'll read three of those. So the first one is my Opus 1. And the assignment was to mimic Emily Dickinson from my English class. And so this is what I did. This is describing the red rubberized asphalt of the track where I would spend 2 or 3 hours every day. It says, "The gritty strip of red contained by gritty lines of white reels by like news, forgot as more appears to claim that sight. He feels the old familiar beast with blunted, icy teeth, aroused by fear, a hunting come and gnaw upon his pith. He stops with others and their beasts, ignoring carefully. They still all watch that crimson curve with fixed intensity. Upon the ears a thunder bursts, behind he leaves his beast, slain by gunshot and the sound of rushing, pounding feet." This English class developed from Emily Dickinson to Robert Frost, and Once again, the final assignment that term was to write a poem in the style of Robert Frost. So, my next running song, called Atrophy. When I was young, I loved to run on roads. It mattered not how crowded, hard, or lone, the running was what counted. And so I learned the roads, the paths, and how they liked my running. One June, I found a road so kind to all my pounding, so soft beneath my feet that moving seemed all hardship. And so upon this trail, I daily ran until I skimmed with grace that startled less those who saw me than I did myself. But there were other lanes and paths and roads. My friends loved not that street, so well was I, and the passage felt my feet above it less, perhaps for not a week or month or year. I stumbled on this path again today and wished to feel it glide beneath me then. But I was older, though still as strong as I had been those distant times. My knees and muscles were inured to roads of harder tread. The trail passed by uncertainly. I broke a spider's sticky silken strand upon my face, and when I stopped to brush the ticklish thing away, my hand was dampened. For when I passed across my eyes, I saw myself, my callow self. How aged I'd become. The trails we find that love to have our feet disturb their bracken breathe to us of heaven so concisely that we doubt they breathe at all. And knowing all their names seems greater than the knowing of the way they feel beneath our feet. Your road must be remembered till the day you find your joy. If they are far apart, remember or forget, it matters not. Your talents lead and leave you in your love. And finally, a running sonnet, which I wrote in iambic galopameter. It's untitled. There are those who never think on running and would stare to see the love I have for unity of breath and foot and calf and rhythm and the constant lucid drumming. I am still and air displaced complains and makes a pressure in the pulse of time that urges endless down my legs and up my spine and twists around the edges of my brain. For toes are meant to force the ground behind, to let me feel the wind and be a wind and form a space inside the skin unthinned, as clear and charged and primally defined as throbbing air when hurricanes are coming. Yes. Yes, there are those who never think I'm running.
If you don't mind, I would like to ask Christian to read that last one again. So much in it, and it deserves a second hearing. Would you mind?
Sure. Appreciate that. There are those who never think on running and would stare to see the love I have for unity of breath and foot and calf, for rhythm and the constant lucid drumming. I am still and air displaced complains and makes a pressure of the pulse of time that urges endless down my legs and up my spine and twists around the edges of my brain. For toes are meant to force the ground behind, to let me feel a wind and be a wind and form a space inside the skin unthinned, as clear and charged and primally defined as throbbing air when hurricanes are coming. Yes. Yes, there are those who never think on running.
I actually did write a little thing about what I think poetry ought to be, but I decided not to read that. My mother is not, and she's like, read it, read it. Okay.
Okay.
I've been outvoted. I don't want to explain my poetry because, in the first place, it seems to me to be a rather futile effort. More often than not, people take what authors have to say about their work as the final interpretation, and since I don't believe in final interpretations, I like to leave my audience, whether or not they happen to be in my presence or not, with a little mystery. Secondly, when it comes right down to it, I can't explain what I really mean. I could explain, and I could explain in a myriad of ways, biographically, formalistically, politically, etc., etc., all of many ways scholars and academics have of explaining and interpreting texts. I'm very good at that. But the fact remains that explaining my poetry does not tell you as much as the poetry itself, and maybe even will leave some of the deeper and unsaid things out. Much like a joke that is no longer funny after it has been dissected, poetry's main purpose is to articulate those aspects of human experience that are inarticulable, and to articulate them ruins the joke. If I could have said all I wanted to say in an essay rather than a poem, I probably would have, but I can't. I realize that this is not a popular concept, but then when have I ever cared about popularity? Isn't it enough that I'm right? So, what I want to tell you instead is what I think poetry ought to be. Whether I have achieved any of these lofty goals remains to be seen, but this is what I strive for, and art is in the striving. For me, poetry is a musical endeavor. What I wish to accomplish with language is what musicians do with notes and scales. A poem should make the hearer, or reader, as the case may be, want to hold the words in his mouth, to make the sounds again with his own voice, to feel those words penetrate into his ear just as one would with a song or a particularly beautiful melody. To my mind, the failing of modern poetry, and I believe that all poetical movements have failings, it's the nature of things, is that it lacks musicality. It is prosaic, and I don't mean that in a derogatory way, but rather as a description. Most contemporary poetry is more akin to prose than sonnets or epics. That is, the poetry that has been written in the latter half of the 20th century is primarily personal free verse, which emphasizes play in language and in form. This is different from previous form and language play, because form itself is no longer subject to iambs and trochees, that being rhythm determined by where the emphasis is placed on the syllable in the word, but is now more dependent upon the subjective construction the poet imposes on the poem's form with the word processor. The ways in which the letters actually appear on the page decide more than syllables how the poem is read and interpreted. So thanks to the tab button, the word dangle can actually dangle right off the sentence. It is only natural that new technology and new processes of printing should affect the way that literature, both poetry and prose, is presented. It's very postmodern. However, in the greed to experiment both with form and personal observation, something has been lost. This is inevitable, as each new movement forgets or derives the traditions and objectives of those that came before it. They say that there is nothing new under the sun. But, like a sitcom reruns on TV, it can be new to you simply because you have never seen it before. It is the universal joke that we will purposely misplace old ideas and customs, only to gush all over them when we find them lingering in the back of drawers after many years. Frankly, I think in poetry that time has come. It is time for another bout of romanticism, of believing in geniuses and the muse. I am bloody well sick of academizing everything to death. I crave a little mystery. I crave in poetry the mystery I find when I listen to music. I crave in language the belief that beyond the words, as beyond the notes and the mathematical formulas of music, there lies something beautiful and eternal, which is probably the real reason I refuse to tell you what any of my poems mean. Why should I? What are they to me is of little consequence as long as they can mean something to you. Isn't that the purpose of art? To transcend personal and private experience and vibrate on some universal level? Isn't that what beauty is? I think so, and I'll just tell you right now that I'm rarely wrong. Though like Cassandra, nobody ever believes me. If you move the table sideways, I say, it'll fit better through the door. No, they all tell me, until lo and behold, 10 minutes later, in a lot of unnecessary perspiration, they decide that maybe I have a point. I can't imagine why this situation should be any different. In any case, I haven't come here to pontificate, even if others have, or even to get you all to agree with me. I came here for the food. Okay. Most of my poems don't have titles, so I'm just going to move from one poem to the other. This is the first one. It came nightly. It, being a he who was a voyeur in her dreams, assembling sarcasm out of fragments of language. And she, the bent and ready dreamer, watches he who watches she as her dreaming unfolds itself upon him like a cat on the neck of its mistress. We begin to wonder who's creating these dreams in which, or so it seems, there is a meaning of things, a story beyond the unwelded joints of each scene. And all of us together want, as thirst wants water, as hunger wants flesh, the connection between he, the shadow in dreams, and she, the dreamer in stark tones. No, we do not know she or he, but only that they are we as we are they, an unbound couple, a mass of undiscovered lovers, wandering between the watcher and the watched, knowing not who is who, neither why they watch, nor why they let themselves be viewed. But only this, the desire, rising like a sunrise, the dawn, a lust always ready to ascend again, though it seems to sink when near the end. And yet we are not she, nor are we he, but only we, the watchers of the watching, the watchers of the watched, wanting what is not ours but theirs, the unvoiced words that dance between them, the dreams of worlds unsaid, hoping to make a me out of this unconsummated we, this separate he and she. Desperate creator of skin and bone, you beat along the syncopated sinews of your child. You, god of wine, feed on my dirty blood. You, my meat of salvation, better flight open to reveal your chattering, glistening innards. And I sing to them, laugh on articulate arteries. Pour forth your hemoglobinous bowels of hatred. Let the unholy guts of men preach of the purity of their bowels. Only here in the grotesque clotting of marrow and muscle will I lay bare my silences. Beat on, red drum, you solid mass of pliant contractions. Regulate the varicose veins and thick green arteries to your expanding, repetitive rhythm. Bleach me white and pure. Leave me free from bruised flesh. I have not been beautiful, but here in this musical moment, I am lovely in blood. I am the alpha and the bellwether of a vicious fate, a conglomeration of blood, conjuring hope into flesh, words into wounds, death into violent silence. I am the stilled breath, a feigned love, the reaper of sins, the king of glib phrases, the forked-tongued steer of souls, in this place where my mouth is the beginning and your lips the omega. Fourth poem. I am in terror. I am torn, caught, and torn again. A whirligig of crisis, a boiling of despair. And what keeps me from standing? What shaking knees bar me from salvation? You who are heaven and earth, you who are life and death, you who are good and evil, what am I but the unbearable pith of existence, the uncertain rhythm of blood? And where should I go when all the lines of my destiny bind me? Oh, ease me, Lord, my horror is not uncommon. Oh, soothe me, Lord, my fear is not unusual. I have looked for you in every star and grain of sand, in every death and sunset, in the radiating wilderness of night. And where were you? All my days have been a cry, silent and unceasing, my longing an endless spiraling song. Let me see you now, beneath my fingers, under my skin, and against my breast. What other comfort is there? I am all a flutter of nerves, a movement too unholy, and where should I look now but down to the toes of my shoes and the sick green carpet beneath my heels? The sky holds nothing for me now. I will be as Buddha, without desire or want. I will sit in full lotus, arms outstretched, palms upward. But it will not be my poised fingers that say to you, come hither, but my breasts, mounting my chin, overflowing the confines of my flesh, my thighs slightly parted, so that though I am without hunger, it will fill you as water fills a glass. Yes, I will be fascinating, as all unattainable things are, drawing you into my arms without ever offering touch. You will find no nurture in my mouth, no milk in my breasts, and when you climb into my lap, we too will form a pietà, a sexless sex. This is the Sistina, and I hope you know what that is, because I'm not going to explain it. Simply said, I am flesh bred from sorrow, but there is more. I am a world of sin, a world of finite words, and you, faithless lover, who are you that brings forth new gods, that calls universes from the dead's blood? Who are you that binds fallen earth to sky? Here, a polluted dawn reddens my sky. She is all bright flame, a roof to sorrow. Though she bears neither the taint of men's blood, nor the knowledge of flesh, the lilies of sin, she is ignorant, as are all the gods. What can they know of a world so faithless? Would you, Lord, have me be no more faithless? Should I be all unknowing as the sky, as free from corruption as all your gods? And should I shed like skin my small sorrow? Should I wash off like dirt my petty sins? Or are my stains as permanent as blood? O heat, the accompaniment of blood, fire of my passion that turns flesh faithless, turns the body of the holy church to sin, turns with the rhythm of the stars, the sky, turns with the plow and the scythe, turns sorrow to rain, to wind, and pits itself against gods. Let us then, you and I, be our own gods. Let us bask in the corruption of blood. No longer will we be slaves to sorrow. No longer will our tongues be found faithless. We will be as heaven, as stars, as sky, shriven of mortality, broken of sin. I will go to the river and wash sin away as the dust of the earth, so gods may look on me and say, she is like sky, pink, and without imperfection or blood. Her breath stinks no more of words gone faithless. Her limbs, now white, have been torn from sorrow. And when I am gone from sin and sorrow, your love, despite gods and crowds of faithless, will, like a morning sky, dawn on new blood. This one actually has a title. It's called Judas Kiss, for obvious reasons. Let me greet you with a kiss, my Lord, that they may know you, and I, in this moment, may taste redemption. Beneath my skin, I have ached for you, for the violence of your blood, for the purity of the just. But I am the catalyst for the salvation of sinners, raising my unclean comrades so that they may stand before you, eye to eye, and be met with a holy kiss. They say it always hurts the first time. He says, shut your mouth and say your prayers. They say it always hurts the first time. He says, there's nothing for you to fear. But I am afraid, as he settles on my bed, and I am afraid as he crawls between my legs. I am all sexual attraction, he says, come a little closer. I am all bent force. He says, I'll make you breathe my name. Still, I am afraid, as his hands wander down. Yet, I am afraid, as his arms close around. They say that pain is brief, but regret is eternal. He says, I'll make this last forever. They say that pain is brief, but regret is eternal. He says, I'll make you love me now. And I do love him, as I wrap around his hips. And I do love him, as I bend for another kiss. He says, woman, you are vicious. I say, only in my teeth. He says, woman, you are sharp. I say, only in my blood. Am I still afraid? Only that he'll leave. Am I still afraid? Only that he'll stay. Like the devil plays the violin, you sing in other worldly music. And I will lay a cool and dusty virgin, a body under glass, until you raise your voice and command me like Lazarus to come. Yes, sing, you Orpheus, you Dionysus, let all your dark and wild words run across my skin. I will not call you Apollo, for your tunes are deeper strains. I will not call you Lord, for you are no master of men. But I will follow, like Eurydice after a song, all your voices' variations into the black and lonely world. I have two more. Just as the wind blows the sand smooth, so have your fingers laid down my flesh. I will be made now into a hillock of earth, a barrel of white bones to set against your teeth, and all my fine thick hair will be as grass. But I am no milk and honey landscape, no promise of rich soil and green valleys. I am a pockmarked earth, all stagnant pools and fallow fields, a ruined nation eclipsing a radiant heaven. I have seen you in the shadows in the air. I have glimpsed you in the candlelight. And you have wound my desire about yourself so that like the moth to the flame, like the tides to the moon, I am bound to rise against the setting sun and hunt for you. No, I cannot be for you some messianic bride. I am neither fertile Zion gathering her lost children, nor a sweet and stalwart virgin bearing greatness in her veins. I am a cursed thing, a dune of thighs, a dry scene of sand and grit, a desert of desire. My want is boundless, as the sea is boundless. My rage is infinite, flowing as the river flows, deep as the river is deep, still as the pond is still. Give me back my love, and I will wish for human things. Unbind my lust, and I will purge my heart of death. As the sun lights the water, as the water revives the land, so the earth will bloom across my lips, sowing seeds in every breath. As the air carries sand, as sound shakes the heavens, so I too will shake the mountains of my body, raise the oceans of my blood, and beat against the firmament to catch you in the threads of my womb. There will be no spring, no resurrection, until I take the heart from your chest and bury it in the sand. There will be no return, no salvation, until the seas and the rivers overwhelm the shores and I flood the dry world with the blood of your brothers. I will come for you in the night, all of creation in my wake. I will level you as land is leveled for the foundations of buildings. Upon your body I will erect the untamed jungles and the cultured plains. Upon your form I will raise the fallen world until you too lie marked with the burden of Creator. And finally, I do not remember you, son of perdition, neither your face, nor your eyes, nor your hair alive with sunlight, and not your voice, your voice that whispers to me in the dark, in my bed. What words you have said to me I have forgotten, as I have forgotten all my hollow promises to love you better and forever. I have forgotten your name until it has become to me the unfamiliar markings of fiction. And my love lies like a sickness in my heart, misplaced and misunderstood. You, my lost and lonely ghost, you, an inverted sun that draws my blood against your skin like a magnet draws metal across the table. You, my brother, my only brother, forgive me, for I stand afflicted with human flesh and failings, and my only absolution for all my forgotten sins against you is to say your name aloud among crowds of unbelievers.
Hey everyone, I'm honored to be able to speak here at Sunstone. I appreciate being asked. It's fun to be back here. My first job was working for Sunstone when I was in high school, and it ruined me for other jobs. Since then, I've had to work for really cool places, so it's very fun to be back here. I've been thinking a little bit about why I write, and as Angela said, it's kind of a hard thing to define. Sometimes I wish that my outlet were something that was a little more marketable. poetry doesn't pay well. It doesn't always seem to have a point, but there are some of us who really just have a need to write poetry. And, you know, what interests me right now, what I want to write about right now is I want to write about God, and I want to write about grace in an interesting way, in a way that's fresh. And it's because spirituality, where I'm at on my spiritual journey, is something that I want to share with other people, and I like hearing other people's stories too. And the other reason I want to write about God is because, you know, it seems like people who are Christian and they have certain associations, and maybe some of you struggle with this too, and I don't think God is a fascist, and I've decided that, you know, that's my message. And I'm going to tell people about that. So he doesn't talk back to them, by the way, in case you're worried. I'm going to worry about that. Yeah. Okay, so here's a poem about grace. Let's see if I can figure out the microphone and how to read too. Okay, falling. When did the falling start? I don't know, but I free fell every day. It lasted years. I mention it now because I know you know what it's like to be wind-bruised, the jerk of barely catching yourself, that dizzy stopping without landing. I fell a long way before I stopped. Look up. No one else is falling. The world is no wind tunnel, but moist grass, bluer sky, and the people you fell past whose eyes you missed are not holding still. Just for now, see what stays and is real. Trees that hold on, flowers that push back, but these short hops blossom to blossom. Okay, this poem is called Lent. Cottonwood, I am God's, but I don't know what this means, carrying spring in my roots. You, gnarled, rotted, wind-beaten, realer than any robin's nest or half-remembered bird song. You have seen dust too, small ones, held bereft cries in your veined heart. You stay, so know that most birds return unscathed, ungrieved. I have never been my own. First snowfall found me unburrowing from his snug daffodil house after a lush autumn, spent beneath red trees, mine, watching geese fly south. Their pulse caught my neck. Why wander cold? I don't know. I had my winter store. Solstice hit hard. I am undone. I can't eat anything but air. You've seen this before. New moist greens become fire, smolder, fall, while you open your empty branches to the cold stars. Even in winter, when darkness falls early, sunlight shines through you. God, I am yours. Show how hunger won't kill will bring me to spring. Okay. This is one that I just finished. I'm not totally sure it's finished, but I'm going to read it to you guys anyway. I have a friend, John O'Connell, who's a painter, and he and I on Sundays would go. We would call it God Days because we wouldn't know what we were going to do, but we would go off on these adventures and we would look for things for him to paint and for me to write about. And this is actually about a camping trip we went on that lasted a little longer. And we had an argument going on about whether or not God was a painter or a writer, and I would say, in the beginning was the word. And he would say, ah, yeah, but then God separated dark from light. So that's kind of fun. Anyway, that's what this. So he made a painting for me, and I told him, and I owed him a poem, so this poem is for John. And it's called Flaming Gorge Desert Mirages. This land might be God's own garden, where he left off landscapes and went wild, pacing, scheming, chirping to locusts, slapped down color, smashed rocks, hollowed pans to his own wicked exile. Some say, here's the world he dreamed and forgot, and maybe even never budded, is a vanishing pool we never tasted, was never in our reach, is no realer than tonight's starlight. Who knows, we might circle back. Meanwhile, we wander this thirsty trail, see which switchback paints scrubby trees, chickadee song, twilight scrambles over pink rock, the hill burn not far back, this scar grass, look how it's heartbreaking green, sweeter than summer should bring. We go on, place bets on rainfall, when, how much. Some pray a man will cross us and tell how it ends. Some say he did. We missed it. We left the path looking for coyote tracks or God knows what. It's fine. We know night will fall, but for now, it's enough to hold up this borrowed sky, forget we are spinning, and watch the dead star seasons, believing what we can see. As sky swings, we wait our turn to fire, while desert moves relentless under our feet. It's home. Still, we are more water than dust. Our roots are all we remember of ocean. Never seen here where land locks, but these rocks help see enormously. Still hurt somehow, we pulled somehow, and when the moon tugs, we'll open. Okay, and this is a love poem. I had to have at least one love poem. I'm also kind of a hedonist. It works with my spirituality. You know, I think that life is here for us to savor. This poem is called Awake. Morning comes cold in blue light. One bird sings. I wake too soon from unsolved dreams. My head is tight as daylight blurs the fading moon. Love, I prayed this greenest leaf to unfold, to drink its dew in sips. Last night's wine tastes less sweet without your teeth on my lips, urging now. Morning waits at the door, brings us doubts on a breakfast tray. I won't want enough, just more, when I show myself out today. But while you wake, let me speak without words. I'm yours, I lie, and mean it. You sigh and pull me away from the half-awake sky. And I will read... Yeah, I will read this one. Okay, and then I'm looking forward to hearing Paul. This one is influenced by Mary Oliver. She's one of my heroes. So is Anne Lamott. I don't know if you guys read Anne Lamott. She's awesome. This is called Why I Raised All of the Blinds in the House on Sundays. Because I kept them closed for years, and old habits die hard. Today's windows hold so much green, ash trees old as Eden, my own small garden. I could forget those badly lit weekends, the 5 a.m. vodka tingling warmth. It was more ache than thirst. Sunday stumbled in bloodshot, muttering regrets, doomed to bring more. Like all who walk in darkness know, you adjust. Still, I'm amazed that I stayed so long in those daydreamed, unlived days. Dreamt nightmares that don't end at dawn. Endured last night, lasting all god-awful night, and a few black-eyed mornings, and I flinched, forgot how to sing. A man lived in that house, we fit. Most days were nearly tedious. Good grief, steep rent there. I would have given anything to stay. What good times and what a tired story. I tell it as warning, as antidote, but not often, I hope. I know the miracles happen are common, but it took years to say, God, take it, show me how to raise dusty blinds, send me one more sky, not heavenly blue, don't scare me. Today's sky is enormous, breasty and gray. The clouds could hold anything. I would not give away what brought me to this brightest, sweet-smelling dawn, not for anything, not even pink champagne. Thank you for listening to me.
So, do we have any doubts about the passion of young poets? Wow, incredible stuff. And to think of the fact that the parents of Christian and Angela and Melissa are well known in this community, have spent years nourishing at the roots what art and culture and belief are in this community. And when people say what's going to happen later on, we've got a preview of it today, and there's a lot more where this came from, no question. And I'm very honored that I met Angela and Melissa at different occasions, and they talked about their poetry, and I go a lot on instinct and impulse, and I said to myself, this, I always ask what I'm going to do with Sunstone, and this year a whole bunch of things of that kind suggested themselves, and this is one of them, and I now know that it was the right thing to do, so thank, be sure to thank them when you get to talk to them individually. Well, I had a book of poetry published last December, and I got some sales reports recently, and gee, I was very excited because they actually paid me some money from what the sales reports, and then I looked more closely at how many books were sold, and I said, yeah, this is poetry, all right. This is the way poetry sells. And, I mean, you know, that proved it, that if I had any doubts about being a poet, this did it. I know what it's like now. But money is, in this field, is the icing on the cake, and the cake is making the cake and watching other people eat it. So thanks for coming today. So what I'm going to do is read you a few things from the book, but then I'm going to read you some poems from another manuscript, which I'm looking for a publisher for, and then we'd like to take some questions from the audience. So I'm going to read you a poem. I think I read it at Sunstone 2 years ago, but it seems right for this time around. And it's a Sunstone poem in more ways than three. But it's it comes at it from sort of an oblique angle, and I think you'll get the drift, and probably all maybe most of you have either heard it or read it before, but I'll take pleasure in reading it anyway. And it's called Eternal Digression. Symposia are rosier in heaven than in hell. In heaven there are a series of hotels. The women in the corridors wear toreadors and gowns and shorts. Some men wear ties, others jeans with button flies. We are uncorrelated here. Corrugated faces show the pain and character of who we've been but are devoid of fear. We vibrate to each other's bodies, meanings, minds. We've come to burn some bridges with our friends and all the holy strangers of our past and future lives. In one hotel, God's in the suite called Honeymoon. His prophet is in 504. Call girls whisper past these gilt-edged doors in stocking feet. Wade the carpet ankle deep. At 3, room service brings a bite to eat. Beneath the great white beehive, the buzz of silence is like ecstasy. Hammock Symposium fills the days. Ballrooms are auditoriums where we speak, play, listen to the eddies of our blood. Flood of memory pools in every fingertip. We touch each other's lives like relics. Pass them. Watch as neighbors fondle our regrets. Her chest the sun, her back the moon. Goddess rising in a glass-walled elevator. Floating a corridor, I enter the arms of a dark woman in white. In another hotel, I fell from her theological spell to find a daughter of noon who named herself Hope. We dine in a room at the bottom. Red flocked wallpaper and lingerie fashion shows. Rows and rows of banquet tables recede in memory. Progressive dinners in the Lafayette, the Grand, the Bonneville. Beneath tricolored canopy on sloping green, aftertaste is dream. Chartered buses move us in the night. Interior lights are out, our destination blank. Across the tracks, City of God's urban underbelly swells with loneliness. All those ballrooms, all those banquet rooms, all those bedrooms, all those hotels. in the Hotel Utah. It was true that at one time in the church's hotel, there were call girls who worked the rooms, I suppose, and were there, and David O. McKay was in 504. At least that's the number I remember. I interviewed him once on the fifth floor of the Hotel Utah, and I think that was the room. I'm, you know, could be 505. Okay. This is a poem that came into this book at the last minute, before it went to press last October, and Signature Books said, if you're going to keep adding poems to this book, it'll never get out. And I twisted their arm a bit, and they sent it around to a couple of people, and well, only one, I guess. A very good poet looked at it and said, you know, there's some things in here I think could be better. And she sent it back to me, and I said, she's right about two of them, and I think wrong about three. So I kept something she suggested, which helped the poem. It's called Black, Blue, Red, and White. Don't tell a blues singer he oughtn't to sing gospel, or when a church singer shuns seduction, sister, just because she gets blues under her skin. Gospel and the blues were born together in a cotton field, soaked red with the blood of black people, delivered as twins in one long cry under the same hot sun and the sin of a slave master's whip. They sang on the slave ship, too. 3,000 miles from home, and I don't even know my name. Didn't know where they were going or how long the trip would last, but they sang so they would last. No way to see the music they would plant in the country of their captivity would grow to outlast every shameful fruit of that errant poisoned tree. As for me, just because I'm white and come to gospel as a pilgrim, come to blues with shoes in hand, because I know I'm on sacred ground, don't mean I'm a stranger to that low and mournful sound. I sat on Rosalie Sorrell's front porch on 2nd Avenue in Salt Lake City with the legendary Sun House, saw and heard him play his red metal-bodied guitar and wail the words to Death Letter Blues. Brownie McGee and Sonny Terry were born to sing the blues, but Jesus whispered, they weren't born to lose, and they sang just a closer walk with thee, and this woman is killing me back to back when I honeymooned with Fate in Toronto in 1968. Lord knows it weren't no easy walk to freedom, and it took a long time for the change they wore to shock us. But the journey started with no more auction block and let my people go. All those field haulers and prison laments in time inflicted doubt in white America. So, Lord preserve those low moans beneath the ark of heaven. Blues and hallelujah, they both shout from the same root. The poem I'm going to read you now was written in the pews of the 11th Ward in Salt Lake City one morning when, I don't know, I wasn't bored exactly. I probably, something was said that got me going on the poem, and it was finished there in church with a couple of changes, I guess, afterwards, but it's called Exegesis, but that's exegesis spelled with a J, exegesis. Jesus was a woman's man, crossed Hades Street to meet the Samaritan at the well, told her everything she'd done,
had some fun with Magdalene, wouldn't leave the wedding till the wine was gone, healed the infirm woman on the street, laid down Martha's broom, save it for my tomb, he said. Wished for Mary's perfumed hair. Lord, he loved the way it felt when she caressed his feet. Hated to board the boat to the disciples. Smell of fish. Okay, the last poem in the book, and this is the last poem I'll read from the book, is a family poem, a personal poem. It started in my sister's living room in Logan a long time ago when we were sitting around discussing what was going to happen once we were all put in the box, you know, and put in the ground. And so here it is, family plot. Cremation's not so bad, I thought. In all creation, there won't be one soul lost in resurrection, no matter if you're drowned, shot, burned, or spurned by the undertaker in the protected covenants of God's little acre. My sister Michael, my siblings call her Grace, proved it years ago by getting cemetery dirt under her fingernails in the family plot. Didn't hurt to scratch a shallow space above my dead infant brother Lloyd, or was it my dead infant nephew Lloyd? There are two of them. And insert her dead husband Phil's ashes. I don't want to step on anybody's toes, my sister said. I tried to point out to her this wasn't the best metaphor to use, but she thought I was being facetious. My brother Dan remembers it differently, swears the cemetery sexton had to approve and officially assign a grave digger to carve out a dwarf plot for Phil's powdery remains so that he could be slipped in under a technicality, since Lloyd, whichever, only occupies half a spot. But we'll all get up from there someday, I thought. Those of us with fat physiques or shit for brains will be transformed. No matter how we died, or were preserved, consumed, or even, God forbid, exhumed. Hold a minute. Turns out there are only 3 graves left and 7 of us still living. Not to mention kids and in-laws. Will those of us buried elsewhere be celestial scofflaws and have to hitch a ride to the big reunion party? Or on the afternoon of the first resurrection, I want to sit on my sister May's bench and read her new poems. So maybe if you're still around when I go under, I wonder, could you burn me, turn me into ash, and slip me in somewhere? That's supposed to be funny, and I'm choked up by my own poem. So, thank you. The new manuscript is called In Sleep and Other Poems. I'm not going to read the title poem because I've read it too many times, but the title poem was published, and hopefully will again if the book ever, you know, gets out. So I'll read the poem that somebody called it the right thing, and now I've forgotten. It's like in Eyes to the World Burned at the Stake, the previous book. There's a poem that kicks off before the first section of the poem, and in this case, it is called Parallel. Like madness, like prison, like a chat room on the internet, it's a perpetual I'm going to start over. Don't mind me. Can't read my own stuff. Parallel, like madness, like prison, like a chat room on the internet, it's a perceptual affliction. A parallel more powerful than garden-style addictions, but it exists. Poetry makes it so you can't see straight. An R. Crumb cartoon begins to look Matisse to you. Perhaps straight's not quite so great as it cracks up to be. You'll want to see, touch, feel life's wavy, crazy surfaces and all that's underneath, the lust, the joy, the grief. From it, cauliflowers of thought erupt, predilections for passion and introspection. You're forced to birth yourself, cesarean section. You have to cut it out of you and nurse it like a baby. It calls for you to play with it, but to stay with it long range is stranger than a live-in lover. Okay, I'm dipping into the middle of the manuscript now to read a poem called Stone Face, which is about a real person who is well known in the poetry world. I'll only give you that much. You'll have to figure out the rest. Those of you who want to make the connection. He once lived in this community, no longer does. Stone Face. His heavy jawline and those fine, hard cheekbones make him resemble Rushmore. Intoxicated by the verse he reads in class, which seems to briefly animate his face, his female students flock to him like birds. Their cries reach crescendo at the trysting place off campus, where his craggy brow becomes a lover's leap for those who camp beneath the overhang and dash themselves against the cruel flint of his eyes. The tall one from Nevada isn't fooled. She comprehends his great stone face, gigantic ego, pure disdain, and sees the sullen child in him, the way his brain is barricaded from his heart, and how his art has made him insular and cold. She laughs at him and makes him dance the two-step to her teasing tone of irony. Once, when she had helped him reconcile his fear, he almost smiles at her. These small erosions wreak some imperfections in the great facade, and when she leaves his mountain for another climb, the sands of time fill in the crags and harden to a handsome haggardness in him that some mistake for character. When she returns, what will he say? Will something loosen in the quarry of his heart? Part of her yearns to shake the ground, to catch his molten anger at its peak and ride it down. But when it falls, the single tear of pity stains her cheek. All right, moving to a totally different tone. A friend of mine named Steve Opater invented a word many years ago, and the word he invented was xerotica, spelled with an X. And of course, your wheels are already turning, and you're making up your own poems in your head out of that. Xerox machines, well. I stole the word from him and made this poem where it came from. It's fiction. Who knows where it came from? It's you can judge it for what it is. Xerotica. I wanted to Xerox her socks off the first time I saw her. sitting there so primly behind her big blonde walnut desk. She was powerful, capable, and cool. When she stood up to her full 5'10", her necklace, double strands of paper clips, extended well below her hips. She spoke with calm authority that seemed to disassemble me. "Go copy these," she said, and handed me a mega stack of documents on double gloss enamel bond, expecting me to reproduce not just the page, but every wrinkle of her agile mind, as if machine were magic wand. I copied, clocked, and collated 1,000 nights for her. The blizzard on her desk was soon so deep, the drifts were like an icon of desire. Lost my place. The drifts were like an icon of desire, dazzling, dizzying, dangerously steep. One morning, just at dawn, I found the avalanche was gone. Her huge blonde desk was clear and clean, and where once stood the dread machine, a small credenza and a fountain pen. The cursive of her own fine hand, I noticed then, the note attached by paperclip to something small and bright. "The key is to my desk, in which you'll find a vial of dexedrine. I dream of you at night." She signed it with an X. You know, I almost finished that poem, and I needed a word with an X to near the end of the poem. The word came into my mind, dexedrine. I'd forgotten what dexedrine was. I didn't even know. I put it in the poem. Later, I got on the computer thesaurus. Well, dexedrine, as you undoubtedly know, is speed, a rather dangerous drug. So, anyway, let's see where we'll go from here for find my list, which I've now misplaced. All right, we're getting near the end here. I'm maybe going to skip a couple of things. Shortly before I met a woman at Cornerstone. No, it's not Cornerstone. It's, help me, Counterpoint. Counterpoint is the Mormon Feminist Conference. Got past flyers from Margaret this morning. It's coming up again right away. I met a woman at Counterpoint at the University of Utah, and she was from Canada, and we talked at the conference, and later started emailing. She was a writer, I was a writer. She sent me some stuff, I sent her some stuff. She looked at my poetry, and I couldn't see her when she read it, so I don't know if she shook her head, scratched her head, but she responded to some of it, and then she started sending me poetry. She had never written poetry. She told me she didn't like poetry. Well, little did she know. So, anyway, I had a dream before I met her. I'm not saying this dream is about her, but I'm not saying it's not either. I don't know. But it works. And the name of the poem is Saturday Night, Sunday Morning. Blissful darkness with only a halo of light from a tube in the wall. Although she arrives without warning and I can't quite recall how I know her, she's comfortable here. I smell her wet hair, close-cropped, color of over-smoke. As we talk, she curls to me and I remove her cloak.
damp from the rain. Because of others in the room who come and go, our stirrings have a slight restraint, yet there is no shame. She comes to me with need so joyous, I name it mine. Standing to receive her, I place my hands inside the open sleeves of her long dress and soundlessly confess that it is she who I have waited for. While on the hardwood floor, clear drops of liquid bead, she leads me to the bed, and rather than lie down, we stand barefoot atop its snowy spread, and there she thrusts to me with such exigency, I want to laugh or cry, a sensual secret in her eye. Post-coital at a table near a door, we sip a cup of something hot. Those who brush past us to an inner room do not intrude upon our privacy. If they have known us in our ecstasy, there is no sign. Across the room, the unmade bed glows softly like a shrine. We touch but do not speak. Dream light from the translucent tube subsides. Well, I'm going to read you one more poem, and I was trying to decide whether to do it. Nobody has heard this poem except for somebody I read it to last night because I finished it yesterday. And, it's in there someplace. It's on the back of the thing I have my list of poems on. There it is. Okay. Ending on a lighter note, I was watching a movie late at night on TV. I have no idea what it was. I only saw part of it. Full of Southern accents. And I love the South through the music of the South. And I love those accents. And something in that made this poem happen. And I guess that's all I need to tell you. Oh, no, what I need to tell you is I need a Southern accent to read this poem, and I'm going to have to fake it, and I apologize for that. When last night, I had it with me, and I saw Belle Clough, who is a friend of ours, and I know that Belle lived in Virginia, and I showed her the poem, and I said, can you read this in a Southern accent? She gave an incredible reading of it. If she were here, I would have her read it. Cut me some slack. I don't have a Southern accent, but the poem has to be read with a Southern accent, so I'm going to try. So the name of the poem is Bituary. That's spelled with an apostrophe and then B-I-T-U-A-R-Y. Bituary. She was just a thin-skinned, southern fried tomato who didn't take shit from nobody. Died with a curse word on her tongue, a lung full of cancer from too many smokes, and in a cheap perfume in her red hair. He told her he'd always be there for her, but what he meant was he'd be there when she went down so he could spit on her grave. Maybe she was a slave to her passions. Maybe she was just too loyal for her own good. But when he thought he'd tell her who the hell was the boss, she gave as good as she got. You rotten sot, she said, who made you God's gift? She'd been in the ground for a year before he felt the loss. Got sappy drunk on Southern comfort. Funny, he thought, she went south, and I never got her recipe for jambalaya. Shit, he spat. But he couldn't swear the way she did with that foul, beautiful mouth. Thank you.
If you have questions, comments, if you want to request poems that you know exist that haven't been heard from the panel,
what do we got? We've got about, well, we've got almost 15 minutes, right? Or are we done? I can't remember.
Okay.
So, what do you want to ask? Where does their stuff come from? That's what I want to know. How does it, well, I'd like to ask, how soon did you know you had something of poetic that you wanted to say? How early in life? And what tipped you that you wanted to keep going with it? You just didn't shove it in a drawer and put it away. Anybody want to respond to that? Yeah, we can do that. Yes, indeed.
I'm probably the wrong person to answer this question. I knew I had something poetic the first time I tried to write something after realizing what poetry was, and then I did sort of put it in the shelf and shove it away. I haven't written much poetry recently, and I definitely feel the lack.
I think I wrote my first poem when I was 5, and from a critical perspective, it was terrible, but what do you expect? And I've been writing ever since then, and I don't know why I keep writing, because there's no money in it. So it must be some sort of compulsion that I can't get rid of, like washing your hands all the time or something like that.
Because obviously we only do things for
money. Well, I only do things for money.
I think you disproved that one.
No, that's not true. Anyway, I don't know why I had the idea that I was going to be a poet. I still claim it's a compulsion. It's not something you can get rid of. And I don't think that all great art is a compulsion. And if you're doing it for, there's no rhyme or reason to it. And trying to, you know, place one on it is just impossible. So.
Well, my mother is a poet, so I don't know if it was destiny or not, but I wrote poems when I was a kid, and she encouraged me to do that. And I never always loved to write, and for a while I stopped writing in my 20s. I had other priorities, and I only wrote a little bit. I'm starting to write now, and I'm at a place where I feel comfortable showing them to people. For a while, I don't think my poetry was very good, but I wrote anyway. I heard that Emma say this, and the guy who's a poet I like a lot, went through this phase where she was really depressed, and she kept writing because she had to, and she was writing these dreadful poems, and she knew they were dreadful, and she kept writing them anyway because she had to. So I always thought it was kind of funny.
Well, I would like to ask Christian. I mean, with the kind of stuff you turned out in high school, holy smoke, you've already started burning down the trail. I'd say you might want to consult your inner voice, whatever, and see what's on tap now, and start it up again. Your motor is running.
I appreciate that. The flattery is always, gets you everywhere with me. I feel like it's been my urge to write poetry has been replaced with a sort of a different attempt at understanding reality, I guess. For me, poetry was always some way of describing reality in a way that you couldn't normally, because it was a piece of reality that you can't see when you're looking straight.
I think
you're right. I definitely should be writing poetry.
When it starts happening, you won't be able to stop.
Well, I'll look forward to it then.
All right.
What was that question, Paul? When did you first know?
As the abstract says, the bug bit me way, way late in the game. I never intended to write poetry. My sister was the poet. I was the journalist. I got into a writing group, and for the first meeting of the group, I was almost finished with a piece of short fiction. I hadn't written fiction since I was in college or shortly after, and so I thought, well, I have something to read, the first meeting, and then I lost the entire story on the computer. You know, I'm not quite as bad with computers these days, but machines don't like me all that much. And so I had nothing, and I thought, oh, wait a minute. There, I did write a poem 10 years ago, one poem. I thought, well, so I read that, and somebody responded to it, and the next meeting I had to come up with something. I thought, well, one good thing about poetry, you can do short stuff. And so I tried and something else, and I was really surprised when stuff started to happen. It was a very curious thing. So now, of course, I have expectations of myself which aren't always fulfilled, and it either comes or it doesn't, and when it comes, it comes, and not meaning, you know, this poem, well, it didn't come all in one sitting, but some of it did, and enough to know that it was going to happen, this last poem I read. But some poems take months. You know, I've had some things on the computer for a couple of years that just don't quite make it. They don't come together. So that's okay, too. You know, it either happens or it doesn't, but it's sure been fun. Other questions for the panel before we close? Thank you very much.
Thank you.